nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, so let's get started. I'm very happy to have Peter Schultz here visiting with us. He's in Sandia National Lab, and he's the main developer of a DFT code named Sequest, and he's going to talk about some of the science he's doing and some of the key attributes of the code. So Peter got his PhD in physics from UPenn in 88, did a postdoc in Sandia, where he started working on DFT. Then he went to General Electric for a couple of years, and then he went back to Sandia National Labs in Albuquerque. Some of you know there's two Sandias, right? One in Albuquerque, one in California. And he's staff member in the multi-scale dynamic materials modeling department. And he's going to talk about some cool stuff with DFT. Let me remind you that we're recording this for the NanoHub. This presentation is going to be available online. So we're going to ask that not to ask questions during the presentation. Hold on to your questions, write them down. Then we'll do the questions right after his presentation. Peter, thank you. Oh, so I forgot to mention the new editor of Modeling and Simulation Material Science and Engineering, which is a very nice journal. It means that I'm going to get lots of requests.
Yes. All right, so what I'm going to talk about today is not so much the Quest code itself, but some neat science that we put into the Quest code. In particular, what I'm going to be talking about is computing defect levels in silicon and about the issue of the band gap problem and how it relates to computing defect levels in silicon. This talk, in a large sense, will be about the process of how you take output from these big codes, right, which gives you lots of numbers and whatever else, and turn it into science that you can relate to reality in some way or another. The reason that we're interested at Sandia in defect levels in silicon, this is an old problem. People have been working with silicon for 20 years. At Sandia, we're interested in this because we're interested about the electrical effects of radiation. Sandia has a great interest in radiation effects in materials, and in particular electronics. The issue being that we have interest in satellites and in weapons. A satellite, you're going to shoot it up, want it to sit there for 30 years. You're paying $250 million to shoot this thing up. It better last for 30 years, but it's sitting in a radiation environment, constantly getting hit by cosmic rays. Weapons electronics, we do nuclear weapons. We put something into the stockpile. We'd like for it to continue to sit quietly in the stockpile for 30 years and not do anything we don't want it to do. And yet, 30 years in, if somebody ever wants to use it, you can pick it up and know that it will do exactly what it's intended to do in the manner in which it's intended to do. Now, the historical approach that we've dealt with this is that you do radiation testing. You estimate how much radiation, whatever circuit or device you're interested in, you're going to take whatever radiation it's going to be exposed to over 30 years, hit it with that amount of radiation. If it survives, it goes into the stockpile or into a satellite. If it doesn't, you're fine, right? And you can do that with neutrons, electrons, gammas, ions, whatever. The reason we have some renewed interest is there are two issues in particular that are driving the renewed interest. One is in long-term aging. What we've discovered is that if you take that same dose of radiation and spread it out over long periods of time, the degradation in your circuit can be an order of magnitude greater than if you had delivered that dose in one prompt dose. Bit contradictory, right? You do this test with one prompt dose, and then you find, well, if the damage when you spread that dose over 10 years is an order of magnitude greater, the thing fails, bad thing. Hard to test because you can't have a satellite sit for 30 years while you're testing whether it's going to survive or not. And then the other thing is dealing with fast transients. The DOE is shutting down all sorts of facilities that have special nuclear materials, which is where we did our testing, right? But we still have the responsibility to decide whether these devices will work as designed. And in particular, the device that we lost was the Sandia Pulse Reactor, which is the way that Sandia tested devices to large doses of neutrons. So the basic way that radiation affects these devices, if you think about it, is that you get some high energy particle which comes in and then creates a damage track. Looks like I'm not going to have a pointer. So up in the upper right here, I have sort of a cartoon of what a cascade damage track might look like. A particle goes winging through a material, creates all sorts of vacancies, has atoms shooting off and creating branches where it has its own bit of damage. And in particular, way to categorize this, you create lots of vacancies and interstitials. You also create lots of electrons and holes. Over time, these vacancies and interstitials diffuse, migrate, interact with each other and other defects. Each of these defects then can also capture electrons and holes. When they capture electron holes, they modify the currents in these devices, and the way that transistors are defined is control of currents. So what might happen is that you have a transistor in a device, you get a radiation event. Here in the lower right, you see a little cartoon. You have a radiation event, and all of a sudden the gain in your transistor goes from 100 or 200 to 10, 5, 1, could even be negative, right? And then recovers over some period of time. And what you would like to be able to do is to determine from modeling what the extent of that effect is going to be and determine whether that transistor will perform as it is designed to perform. So the model that we've adopted, since we can't do testing, we have to do something to figure out how these devices are going to respond to radiation. So you can't do it in one shot. You can't stick your circuit into a cavity inside a nuclear reactor and hit it with neutrons. So what we're going to do is a multi-scale effort, starting with the atomistic damage and working all the way up to circuits. So we're going to start with DFT calculations and atomistic simulations and take a look at the nature of the defects, compute their properties, parameterize them, feed them into device models, and take a look at continuum models of transistors, say, and take a look at their response and their evolution in time subject to the fields and biases that exist and the device configurations that you have, and compare those to experiment, and then parameterize and compartmentalize those and feed those into circuit models. And then the hope is that you can go from the radiation damage and simulate electrical response and determine whether a device will succeed in much to replace and simulate what you had with testing. Okay. So from the atomistic point of view, which is where we're interested in, this is the world that we're going to deal with. We start off with interstitials and vacancies, lots of them, right? And in silicon, these migrate through the silicon lattice and they interact with dopants that you intentionally introduce, such as boron, phosphorus, or arsenic, and impurities that you can never get rid of, common impurities being carbon and oxygen. And you form complexes, boron interstitial, carbon interstitial, the vacancy oxygen pair, also known as the A center vacancy, boron vacancy, phosphorus, and then these further can migrate through your lattice and create yet more complex defects. Each of these has different charge states, which means that these things can capture electrons and holes, chewing up your carriers. Some of these, there's a great deal of information known in the literature, but some of it, there's almost no information in the literature, and what we're going to use density functional theory for is to fill in the gaps in our experimental knowledge. And the kinds of things that we want are sort of, okay, the energies of the capture of the holes in electrons, the reaction energies between the different defects, the diffusion barriers for the defects, so that we can work out the temperature-dependent, field-dependent evolution of things in continuum simulations. And on top of it, we want to figure out what it is that we don't know about these systems, right? Things that we can't measure. So the problem with the experimental record, and the reason we can't do everything in experiment, is that the experimental record, despite 30 years of study, is not all that complete and is at times a complete mess. And in the ideal cases, you can get, say, defect levels, like for the A center, to within 3/100 of an EV, essentially a thermal energy. But there are many defects, such as the boron interstitial, where even experimentally they quote an uncertainty a 1/10 of an EV. And then there are defects like the silicon self-interstitial or vacancy where you know very little about the information about the defect levels. Okay, so what we're going to try and do is use density functional theory. And the thing that in the past is that density functional theory is quite unproven for computing defect levels in silicon. We know from long experience that using density functional theory, we can get structural energetics to within about a tenth or two of an EV in these materials. So there, if we're going to be computing defect levels, which is a change in charge state, right, the best that we can hope for is the accuracy with which we can get the reference state, so it's about a tenth or two of an EV. So then the question is, for our continuum simulations, what kind of accuracy do we need? Do we need 30 kilovolts, or is 1 to 2 tenths of an EV good enough? Well, if it's 30 millivolts, we're in trouble because the experiments aren't even that good, right? So we can't hope the theory is going to be better. The current device simulators that we have, and we have a number to choose from at Sandia, are using data that is based on experiment, which is roughly about a tenth of an EV with imperfect knowledge. So that is our target. We need to get results for defect levels from density functional theory calculations that are about a tenth of an EV. We can do better than that, wonderful. If we're doing worse than that, then we're not really providing any value. So how these defect levels matter is, if I have some kind of localized defect, right, and it has a level in the gap, where that level in the gap is matters a great deal for how it chews up carriers. So if I have a level that where I have an electron that's very close to the conduction band, it takes very little energy to eject it into there, but it's a long ways from the valence band, and the same thing with the valence band. If it's very close here, then it takes very little energy to excite an electron from here into the defect state. It's these guys in the middle that are a real problem. They're called recombination centers. What happens is that with equal frequency, they can chew up a carrier from the conduction band and a hole from the valence band, and it just catalyzes the destruction of your current. And these are the guys that you really care about, and this is why we want to quantify them carefully. Another problem that we have in density functional theory is a so-called band gap problem. Experimentally in silicon, we know that the energy necessary to promote an electron from the valence band into the conduction band is about 1.2 eV, right? If you do a DFT calculation, be it local density approximation or GGA, and you take a look at the Cohn-Sham DFT eigenvalue spectrum, you end up with a gap, but that gap is only half a volt. Gallium arsenide, experimentally, you have a gap of 1.5 eV. Again, DFT, LDA, gives you about half a volt. This, however, is the energy scale you're interested in, right? You want your defect levels to fit into there, and you want to compute the energy of excitation to a band edge within a tenth of a volt, and all of a sudden you have a band gap that's only half a volt. You could have a real problem, and the question then arises, is this a real impediment to do a fundamental impediment to doing anything meaningful in DFT? Okay, the next problem that you have in DFT is you're not doing exactly the problem that you want to do. So the problem you want is some isolated defect in an otherwise perfect bulk material. If you look at the ideal case, that's an infinite number of atoms, and even with today's computers, an infinite number of atoms is a few too many to compute. So in a practical sense, what you do is apply something called a supercell approximation. So instead of doing an individual defect, you make periodic copies of that defect so that you're taking a look at a crystal of defects. And the idea is that you have this defect region, and you buffer it with enough bulk atoms so that they're isolated from one another. And then in the limit of big enough cells, you get reproduced reality. The problem is that this ideal is very difficult to achieve. For example, as a simple example, if my defect had a dipole in it, right, and I buffer it with a significant number of atoms, as here in the upper right, well, the defects are still interacting one another because the tails of the dipole extend a long way, so the defects continue to interact in the kinds of cells that you can do with a DFT calculation. But life gets even worse if I have a net charge. If I'm computing a defect level, I'm computing a change in charge state, so I'm going from neutral to minus, or neutral to plus, or so on. And if I have a periodic array of charges, it doesn't matter how big I make the cell. The potential and all the electrostatic quantities diverge to infinity. So I have formally an ill-defined problem. And these are things that you have to deal with if you're going to do rigorous calculations of defect levels in semiconductors. So to summarize the kinds of issues we have to do, we have to figure out how to deal with the boundary conditions. How do we deal with the net charge? We need to get rid of the infinity, And then we also would have to get the correct asymptotic behavior going off as Q over R as we go off to infinity, right? How do we establish a chemical potential? These electrons are coming from someplace and to someplace, and if we're going to construct a valid energy expression, we have to know the energy of bringing that electron from some reservoir. And then we have to deal with two kinds of finite size effects, right? One is sort of this business of interacting defects, where defects interact, and instead of being discrete states in the gap, they form these bands, because I have a crystal of defects, not a discrete state. And then the other one is that if I have this very small defect, right, it's going to incur a large polarization effect from the bulk, but I'm only doing a very small cell, so we have to incorporate that. Now, if we do that to fix the supercell problem, at the other end is lurking the DFT band gap problem. So if we manage to do the perfect calculation, are we killed by DFT band gap problem? So the standard way that people have eliminated the divergence in the Coulomb potential is to apply what's called a Jellium neutralization. So what you do is you start with your defect, create a periodic array of defects, and then on the bottom right you add a uniform background charge sufficient to neutralize the density within each particular cell. What could possibly be wrong with this? Well, it's worthwhile to go and look at where the divergence came from. So in our isolated defect, we've got our net charge here in this central supercell, and we're doing a one-dimensional supercell calculation. And we've got these tails from the charge that go off as Q over R, but that's not what we're doing, right? We're adding periodic copies of this thing, and each of these periodic copies is generating a Q over R tail, which overlaps the potential in the central cell to the point, and Q over R dies off slowly enough that all of these conspire to add up that you go to infinity. The interesting thing to note is that the infinity you're generating is not flat, and you can see that by taking a look at the curvature of each of these Q over R as you go from the center of the cell. So if I take a look at this corrupting potential, there's this curvature so that it dips down as it goes toward the center, right? So you can easily convince yourself that you're going to infinity at the boundaries faster than you are at the center of the cell. If you're doing a Jellium neutralization, you're actually not adding a uniform background to your density. What you're doing is you're removing an infinity in the potential, and the infinity that you're removing is a flat infinity. And it's easy to construct a toy problem that proves this to yourself. So just consider an isolated charge density and make it a Gaussian charge, right? It's easy enough to compute the analytic potential in all space of an isolated charge. It's just Gaussians and error functions, right? Alternatively, stick it in a box, periodically replicate that box, apply a Jellium background charge, and use your standard periodic Poisson solvers, such as FFTs, to compute a potential. When you're done with that, well, you still have a problem of where do I set the zero. So let's set the zero so that the potential of this Jellium neutralized charge is identical to the analytic potential at the center of the charge density, and then compute the difference in the potential over the volume of the box. Right? And this is what happens in the lower left is what happens when I take a look at the difference between the analytic, the correct potential, isolated potential, and the Jellium potential along a line that goes from the center of a cubic face across the center of the box to the other face. Now, at the center of the cell, we set them to be equal. This is a box that's 10 bore on a side. And as I go to the side of the box, the error in the potential is 2 volts. 10 bore is an interesting number. That's roughly the lattice parameter for silicon. So this box that I just described would be an 8-atom silicon cell. And I have a 2-volt error in the potential going across that box. What people did 10, 15 years ago was do a 64-atom silicon cell that's about 20 bore on a side. Well, the error as you go to the side of the box then is about a volt. A volt's an interesting number. I just told you that the band gap in silicon is 1.2 eV. So this error in a 64-atom cell in the electrostatic potential probed by an electron is off by an average roughly a band gap error. So you're in trouble. Well, let's make the size bigger. Computers are getting bigger. Codes are getting bigger. If I go to 216 atoms, which is 30 bore on a side, the error is 0.67 eV. 0.67 eV is another interesting number. That's the band gap in germanium. If I go to 512 atom cells, people are beginning to do 512 atom cells in silicon. That's 40 boron aside. The error is half a volt. Well, half a volt is the LDA band gap. You're in trouble, and you're not going to be able to grow your way out of it using a gallium neutralization. The error that you're making in the potential is of the scale of the energies that you're trying to probe in your defect levels. So how do you fix this? This is something I did about, 8 years ago now. So we're going to take advantage of the fact that the solution of Poisson's equation to compute the Coulomb potential is linear in the density. And we're going to start off with our defect that has some net charge in it. And we're going to start breaking up the density into pieces. And I'm going to create a model charge density that has my net charge and, in principle, whatever multiple moments I'm interested in, and a residual charge density that then has no charge. For this model charge density with this charge, I'm going to solve for the Coulomb potential using localized boundary conditions as if this was isolated in space. I can use a Gaussian that I just described in the previous, in the previous view graph, and that has the proper boundary conditions with a zero set so that the potential goes off to zero at infinity. The residual charge density that has no net charge in it, I just apply my standard periodic boundary condition method, for example, FFTs, and compute the potentials if I had a periodic array of these. I take these two potentials, I add them up to create a total potential, which I can do because my potential is linear in the density. And then I get a potential around this charge defect that looks like, instead of being a periodic array of positive charges, now it's just a periodic array of defect charge that has no net charge. So therefore, it does not have these long corrupting tails from the multiple density. So what we've done is rigorously avoid this Coulomb divergence. We haven't ignored it or swept it under the rug. We made sure it just never happened from the beginning because we've applied the right boundary conditions to the right parts of the problem. Okay, I'm going to skip that part. A quick way to see how this has an effect is to go back to what was state-of-the-art 10 years ago, which was from Makoff and Payne. We did a background charge neutralization, then you did all the various energy manipulations necessary to give you a good energy expression. And here is a couple of view graphs from there where they were computing the ionization potential of a magnesium atom otherwise isolated in space. And what you see is as they increase the size of the box, right, the computed ionization potential for the levels, the best that you could do is about a tenth of an EV as I increase the size of the box, right? Yet the magnesium atom has a fixed discrete ionization potential. And this is simply a reflection of the fact that I've got this 1 over L error in the potential and in the energy and in the chemical potential. If you use this method I just described, which I've called the local moment countercharge scheme, as you increase the size of a box, and we did molecular calculations, we took a look at the ionization potential of methane, the total energy of a sodium chloride diatomic molecule, which has a huge dipole but no charge, and then another system, we took a look at the electron affinity of the hydroxyl ion, where we have both a dipole and a charge, and we increase the size of the box from a box that's sufficient to contain the density of the molecule to however big we want it. The largest variation you get is 10 to the minus 3 EV. And you take a look at all the quantities, the eigenvalue spectrum, whatever else, there's no variation of the function of box size. So what we've done then is demonstrated that we've correctly removed the divergence, and now we're treating the potential of an isolated charged species correctly. Okay, I'm going to skip that part. In bulk, life gets a little bit more complicated because instead of vacuum, you've got more bulk material. But this was a set of calculations where we demonstrated that you could generalize this idea into a bulk environment. And we did three cases to satisfy ourselves that we had done this well. One was a one-dimensional chain of sodium chloride where we had alternating sodium chlorine, sodium chlorine. So essentially, we have a one-dimensional salt crystal. And then we removed a chlorine atom, created a vacancy. That leaves behind an electron that's trapped by a modeling potential. As a one-dimensional left center. You can do a number of things with that electron, but one of the things you can do is ionize it into vacuum. And then take a look at the ionization potential as a function of how far apart you put the chlorine vacancies. And what you see is that it very quickly settles down to a value, you know, 4.6 OeV. And if you do the analysis as you go here, this thing goes roughly as 1 over L cubed, which is what you would expect from one-dimensional classic dielectric screening theory. If you were to try this with a gellium neutralization, there's no way to avoid 1 over L, which would be the incorrect physics. So here, what we're showing is that we're getting the correct physics for a one-dimensional system. You do a two-dimensional system, a sheet of these atoms, sheet of sodium chloride, right? So you have a one-layer thick sheet of sodium chloride, create a vacancy, chlorine vacancy, compute the ionization potential, and again, compute the energy. We went all the way out to 324 atoms, at which point we got bored. And you do the analysis, this thing again goes off as 1 over L cubed, which is what you expect from classic dielectric screening in two dimensions. And in three-dimensional bulk, this is just strictly an F center, right? We've got fewer points here because in three dimension, numbers get pretty big pretty quickly. But this thing goes off as 1 over L with an asymptotic value of 3.2. You would get 1 over L with gellium. However, here you get something where the 1 over L is due to the physics and the problem. And the physics that we're getting here is as we make our cell bigger, you have a larger volume that can polarize to screen the charge, and that should go off as 1 over L. It isn't an error in the potential. It's just very well controlled fact that we're increasing the volume that's available for screening. Okay. The next thing that you have to deal with is how do we quantify the energy of bringing an electron, a charge, into our system? We have to figure out some sort of reference potential. In 1981, Kleinman showed that in a bulk material, you can't do it. You have to specify some kind of arbitrary external boundary condition. You can't do it internal to an individual calculation. What people have traditionally done to get around this is a variety of ad hoc procedures. Right? You take your perfect crystal cell, you take your defect cell, right? You compute a DFT band structure, and you say, well, I've got my valence band edge here in the crystal cell. I've got my valence band edge someplace in my defect cell. If I can identify it, these things are offset from one another, and I'm going to correct my energy by the difference. Or I'm going to use potential at some point in space or core level at some point in space. The problem with these is that all of these are, to some extent, arbitrary. Which feature do you use? Is it a conduction band, the valence band edge? The defect itself modifies these, so what is a valence band edge or a conduction band edge isn't well known. It is always, to some extent, arbitrary, and you use different schemes for different kinds of defects because the numbers work out differently. Empirically, the scheme is no better than a few tenths of an EV, and a few tenths of an EV is too far to be off because we have a standard of about a tenth of an EV. Part of where this comes about, this is more about the chemical potential. So the typical way that you write a formation energy of a charge defect, right, is you do your DFT calculation, and this is the number that is produced by your DFT code, the first term. Then you remove the crystal reference energy. So if I'm doing silicon, I remove silicon atoms. Then you have a change in particle number. If I create a vacancy, right, I've removed a silicon atom, so I have to remove that number of particles that have that reference energy. And then I have a charge times a chemical potential referenced to some valence band edge. The problem with this expression, and the reason that this reference energy matters, this chemical potential matters, is that embedded in the DFT calculation itself is this error in the potential where I've got this potential of my defect is some periodic potential reference to something fixed plus this unknown constant, right? I can only compute the potential to within a constant, and I don't know what that constant is. This constant matters when I have a net charge because there you have a contribution to the energy that is equal to this charge times this constant, and therefore you have two terms which are charge-dependent embedded in your energy expression, right? And this is where the difficulty is and why you have to worry about what this constant in the potential is. The way to get around this is also something I described a few years ago. So the problem also exists in the calculation I just described to you. So we got to the point where we had this defect with a net charge, right, embedded in a matrix of a periodic defect density. But if I have this periodic defect density and I do my standard FFT or the like, I still have this constant that defines the periodic boundary condition, times the net charge. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my defect, my DFT energy, and I'm going to subtract that term. So here's my model charge, right, times the potential, which has this unknown constant in it. I don't know what it is, right? And I'm just going to remove that from the energy expression. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to reverse the order in which I had done this integral. So instead of doing the density of the charge times the potential due to the defect density, I'm going to take the potential due to the density due to the defect charge in the volume of the cell times the potential due to the model charge, where I've controlled the boundary conditions. This thing is going off to zero at infinity, so I've fixed the boundary conditions correctly, right? So that gives me the energy back of the density interacting with itself within the volume of the cell, which I want. Now, what I'm left with at that point, then, is that this density isn't interacting with anything in the outside world. We don't want that. So what we do is we bring that back by taking this model charge density and embedding it inside the crystal potential, the periodic crystal potential of the same supercell, right? So I take my defect model charge density, add the crystal, multiply by the crystal potential, and integrate over the volume of the cell. The problem is now this charge is interacting with the crystal density inside the cell. We don't want that. So again, we do this trick above where we reverse this. We take the crystal density inside the volume of the cell, multiply it by the model charge density potential inside the volume of the cell, and therefore we remove this interaction. What we've done here then is gotten rid of this annoying constant, which is going to be dependent on the supercell you use, the defect, the configuration of the atoms, and we've replaced it with another constant, which we also don't know and is also arbitrary, but this constant now is the same for every defect in every supercell in every calculation we do. So we've defined an energy expression that defines a common reservoir for charge coming in and out of our supercell. Okay, so this is the path that we've taken so far. We start off with an ill-posed problem, gotten rid of our divergence, and we fixed the chemical potential. Next thing is, what about the bulk polarization? So we're doing a calculation that's inside the volume of the cell, right? But that neglects the polarization response of the full infinite crystal outside the volume of the cell. And the way that we deal with this is a classical model that goes back to at least Yost in 1934 and to Born before him, where you take a look at the energy, polarization energy that you get in a structureless dielectric around a spherical cavity. And we're going to set the volume of the spherical cavity to be essentially the volume of our supercell. At the lower left is sort of the classical estimate of what that energy corresponds to. And we're going to add that to our energy expression. Next thing we have to deal with is the defects interacting with one another. If I had a perfectly isolated defect, I would have a discrete state in the gap that would be flat, but because our defects interact with one another, they form a band and they disperse just like the valence band and conduction band. So here's a little cartoon about what's happening. So at the bottom, I've got the valence band, which is fully occupied. At the top, I've got something that looks like a conduction band. And the index is across k points, and we're doing in our DFT calculation or sampling at a finite set of k points, so you see these little places where we put electrons. This is what your DFT calculation looks like. So if I have a defect band that is empty with zero electrons, I add an electron, and I apply the standard scheme for doing things. I use a Fermi level, and I raise the Fermi level until I've occupied enough states to use up all of my electrons. I add a second electron, and I add some more. The problem with this is if I have one electron in a defect state, I know in nature I've got one state, right? Singly occupied orbital. Well, here I've got either doubly occupied orbitals or empty orbitals. That doesn't give me the correct asymptotic limit. Worse, if I had a second electron and the electrons go into the conduction band, I don't have a model of the defect at all. I've got a complete supercell artifact that bears no relationship to reality. This actually proves to have a relatively simple solution. It's something I've called a discrete defect occupation. Instead of using a global Fermi level to define occupations across all your k-points, what you do at each individual k-point, you apply an Aufbau principle, and I stop when I've added one more electron than the base number of electrons at each K point. And then what you see is that this defect band is occupied by one electron all the way across the band, which then goes to the correct asymptotic limit. Even better, if I add a second electron, I end up having two electrons on the defect. So if I have a double minus defect, I have a true double minus defect instead of a partially double minus defect and some number of electrons confined in a supercell in the conduction band. Okay. So now we've dealt with all the issues that I laid down. So the next question is, what about DFT's band gap problem? So here's sort of a cartoon of the entire model that we've done. So what we wanted at the beginning is an isolated charge defect that engendered a polarization problem, right? We go to the standard supercell model of a periodic set of charge, which is ill-defined. We fix the boundary conditions, chemical potential to embed it in a crystal. We've added the bulk polarization, then we do the discrete defect. And I've called this the finite defect supercell model. So what we've done is taken the calculation that comes out of our raw DFT code and brought ourselves back to something that looks like the system that we want to compute. Right. The energy expression changes a little bit because nowhere in here have we mentioned anything about a valence band edge. Right. What we're doing is computing formation energies of total defects with respect to some reference. So you start off with your defect calculation, you again remove sort of the crystal energy and the chemical potential times the change in particle number for any missing or added atoms to the crystal. You have this chemical potential fix, and then you have this polarization energy, and then that gives you a formation energy. And then to compute charge transitions, you do what you would do in a molecular calculation. If I want to do an electron affinity of a hydroxyl ion, I take a negative the energy of a negative hydroxyl ion, subtract the energy of a neutral hydroxyl, and that's my electron affinity. Well, that's what we're going to do here. Okay. The method that we're going to use is the Quest DFT code. It has a rather good website that tells a variety of its features. It is a sort of standard general purpose pseudopotential Gaussian-based orbital DFT code with all the various switches and toys that you would expect from a good DFT code. The thing that probably distinguishes it from a lot of other codes is that it's particularly fast. It's small, it's accurate, it's powerful. You can do hundreds of atoms on a desktop. And we even have some parallelism in the code, which makes it go even faster if you have a parallel computer. But you don't need a parallel computer to do these calculations I just described. We're going to skip that. Okay. So Quest is a Gaussian-based code, and this is how it gets its speed. Gaussians are atom-centered. They have a finite extent. And the way that you get to the speed is that you end up with two kinds of matrix elements in the Hamiltonian that you're trying to compute. One is I have some kind of atomic potential, and I'm computing matrix elements between orbitals over that atomic potential. And I only need to worry about those which all mutually overlap. If one of the orbitals is far away, that term is going to be zero. And with efficient use of cutoffs, you can make those terms go away. So you end up with something where you only have order n matrix elements to compute. The other part that you're trying to compute is you end up with a potential over a grid. And then you're computing matrix elements between orbitals over a grid. And again, the only terms you need to worry about is those where orbitals overlap the same region in space. Both of these things are order n, and with efficient implementations and good use of cutoffs, you can actually see that order n, which you can see here. So this is an example calculation that we did just to show the scaling. Don't worry about the timing. These calculations are about 15 years old now. We're just going to worry about the scaling. What we did here is took slabs of ruthenium and started with a one-layer slab, three-layer slab, five-layer slab, seven-layer slab, kept increasing the slab number, and taking a look at the time that it took to compute various parts of the calculation. So here I show the three expensive parts of the calculation. Is the computation, two parts of computing the Hamiltonian, and then the eigensolver. And what you can see is that the cost of the calculation in computing the three-center matrix elements over the potential gets to order n and gets there quickly. Same thing with the grid-based matrix elements. It also gets to order n and gets there quickly. And slowly, the eigensolver is beginning to show its n-cubed behavior, right? The interesting thing, and this surprised us a little bit, is that we are order n once we get beyond three layers. Right, so at once you're beyond second or third nearest neighbors, you're already in the order n regime computationally. This is another calculation where you take a look at the average per atom cost of a self-consistent Hamiltonian. This is going back to the two-dimensional sodium chloride. Right, so if this were perfectly order n, I would expect something that is flat. You can see we're pretty close to flat early on. Then there appears to be a jump, and it gets to flat again. That has to do with some internal parts in the code. But what you see here is that we are very, very close to order n in the computation of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so back to the defect supercells. The calculations that we did for the silicon defects, we used the Sequest code with all the machinery I just described to you for doing defects with both LDA and PBE, fully converged K-point sampling. We did calculations from 64 sites to 512 site supercells. The final series I'm going to show you were at 250 sites. So it's 5 by 5 by 5 by the 2-atom FCC primitive cell using a 2-cube K-point grid. We did full relaxation of the atomic positions to high tolerance. And the lattice parameter for the supercell was fixed at the theoretical values, which I've shown here. Okay, so what we did is we start off with a perfect crystal. And here is just a cartoon example of a silicon self-interstitial. If you add an extra atom in the lattice, it can do a number of things. It can try and share an atom site with another silicon atom. This is the common, what's called a 110 split interstitial. Or it can go into a tetrahedral site. You can go into this. You try the various possible atomic configurations. You do a free relaxation. You compare the energies. You pick the one that's the lowest energy. This is a sequence of defects that we've done. We've actually done more, but these are the ones I'm going to talk about. So we start off with the interstitial vacancy. Oxygen substitution, sulfur substitution, nitrogen substitutional, the dye vacancy, carbon interstitial, boron interstitial, phosphorus vacancy pair, boron vacancy pair, and then over all the different charge states that we found for these defects, ranging from minus 2 to plus 2. And the ones that we show you are the stable defects. The blue squares are where you don't have defects. So if you take a look at the silicon self-interstitial for the double minus, minus, and the neutral, it takes this split interstitial form where two silicon atoms share a single atom site separated along the 110 axis. If you go to the positive, the silicon atom pops into the unbonded tetrahedral interstitial site. If in the single plus, it's slightly distorted. For the vacancy, it's tetrahedral in the double plus. There's D2D tetragonal distortion for the single plus and neutral. And for the minus charge, you get the split vacancy where a nearby atom goes halfway in between two silicon sites. And you can see this going all the way across the board of the different optimizations. The red things that you see are essentially the extra atoms of the oxygen. You hear in red bridges between two silicon atoms, and then you have a pairing between the other two silicon atoms. So you can think of this as half a vacancy and an oxygen bridging between two silicon atoms. Both LDA and GGA give the same structures. Here I show LDA, there's one exception. The GGA in the single negative for the vacancy site, instead of doing the split vacancy, ends up with a C2B distortion where you start off with a neutral vacancy and one of these bonds gets longer. But other than that, GGA gives identical results. So what you do then is you take all of those defects in their lowest energy form, take the differences in their formation energies, and that gives you ionization potentials. And this is with the interstitial, I had five charge states, so I have four charge transitions, right? Double minus to neutral, neutral to plus, plus to double plus. And this is done for all the defects that I just showed you before. The thing to note is that all of these things are referenced to a common electron reservoir, which I have no idea what it is, right? It comes out of the periodic crystal calculation. It's some arbitrary value, but it is the same for all of these. And then the other thing to note is the energy scale, right? You go from the top of the scale to the bottom of the scale, right? The range in energies that you see for the ionization potentials is about 1.1 eV. That's an interesting number. That's just smaller than the experimental band gap in silicon. There is no sign of a band gap problem in the width of the ionization spectrum that you see here. Experimentally, for those same defects, this is what is known, right? So here we have our valence band. These open squares are the experimentally observed levels. which you'll notice that for the interstitial and vacancy, next to nothing is known. These are the guys that, for our purposes, we care about a lot. Because when you have your initial radiation event, you're creating lots of interstitials, lots of vacancies, and the early time chemistry of these things is going to be dominated by these guys. We know nothing, right? So this is really what we're trying to fill in. Except for the vacancy, you know the transitions for the 0+ and plus to double plus. The oxygen substitutional, the so-called A center, is 1,700ths of an eV below the conduction band. Sulfur has two levels. It can lose both of its extra valence electrons in comparison to silicon. Nitrogen has one level. The divacancy has three observed levels, carbon interstitial, top and bottom, boron interstitial, phosphorus vacant, and so on. But the thing is, we're silent on the most important defects, and this is where we care about the most. So what we're now going to do is overlay the theoretical spectrum that I showed you before with ionization potentials with the experimental one. The only thing is, there's one parameter, right? Where do we put the valence band inside of our ionization, computed ionization spectrum? And we set it up in a way so that overall average things line up reasonably well. It doesn't matter that much. And this is what you get. So these are the guys that we were looking for, right, for the interstitial and for the vacancy. But if you take a look at the other levels, it's actually quite surprising how well you do. Certainly, I was quite surprised when these numbers started popping up. So getting one number right is no big deal because we fixed one number, right? We've set where the valence band is here, right? So let's just say that the oxygen substitutional, we're within 17, we're within 200ths of an eV of 1,700ths below the conduction band. That could be just fixed. Our vacancy levels are within a tenth of an eV of each other. Our sulfur, well, we're not doing so well for the 0 to plus. We're off by 2/10 of an eV. Nitrogen is within a tenth of an eV. The divacancy, it's almost embarrassingly good, the results we got here. The carbon interstitial, we get the minus to 0, and the 0 to plus also within a tenth of an eV. The boron interstitial is what's called a negative Hue defect, right? It's cheaper to remove the second electron than it is to cause the first electron. LDA gets this wrong. It gets the standard ordering, goes from plus to 0 to minus as I go up in the level. And the phosphorus vacancy and the boron vacancy, the known levels were done pretty well. At the time that we did this calculation, the phosphorus vacancy was known to have a 0 to minus transition, but there was no 0 to plus transition known. Same thing with the boron vacancy. There was experimentally, there's a whole mess of levels, all of which are attributed to different 0 to plus. We got a plus to 0, 0 to minus. The thing that was interesting about these new transitions that we found was that they were roughly in the middle of the gap, and we care about things in the middle of the gap a lot because they're effective recombination centers, so they're very important for the downstream simulations. But overall, looking at this spectrum, what you find is that the largest error we have is about a quarter of a volt, 0.25 eV, and that was for the boron interstitial. The average error, here's an interesting number, 0.08 eV. There's our tenth of an eV accuracy that that was demanded of us when we set down on this path. And if you just strictly restricted your attention to vacancy-like defects, we were doing even better than that. These new defects that we found, the phosphorus vacancy and the boron vacancy, we find them in mid-gap, and we can believe that they exist because how far away are they from the edge? 4,500ths of an eV, right? That's much, much larger than our maximum error, than our average error. These things are real. They exist. They must exist. They may not have been experimentally observed, but we know they're real. They'll have to go into the simulations. There are a few problems in here. The boron interstitial is not negative U in the LDA calculations. The vacancy is also negative U experimentally, and we don't see that in the simulation. Though here, this is less of a concern because we're within roughly a tenth of an eV. GGA, pretty much nothing changes except for one important thing. Our boron interstitial is now negative U, right? You get the proper ordering in the charge state. Now, the way that you get negative U is that you get a relaxation in one of your states that causes the geometry of the defect to change, and that relaxation energy more than makes up for the extra energy to remove the extra electron. And we know that GGA does much better at making and breaking bonds. LDA overbinds, right? So the cost for breaking a bond is overestimated. GGA does a much better job. And since we have a change in the bonding arrangement of these atoms, GGA does it better. It gets it right. The reason we care about this is when we take a look at our interstitial, right? these bottom defects, going from zero to plus, plus to double plus, we also had a bonding configuration change where the number of bonds was not conserved in the system. These are the guys that we really care about, right, with the interstitial. And the fact that GGA does a better job on the boron interstitial and getting its negative U properties then says that we should believe those results for the interstitial. The max error went down a little bit. Instead of quarter of a volt for LDA, we're now at 0.17 EV, but the average error overall is, again, less than a tenth of an EV, which was what we were targeted. Let's see. Yes, I saw a little bit of time. So why did I go looking for the phosphorus vacancy and the boron vacancy state? It related to the fact that these defects are isoelectronic with just the pure vacancy. Phosphorus vacancy is just like the vacancy, except I've added an extra electron to the state. So the neutral vacancy is isoelectronic with a phosphorus vacancy pair with a plus. The minus is isoelectronic with a neutral. Double minus is isoelectronic with a phosphorus vacancy minus. Experimentally, the minus to zero transition had been observed, right? And the double minus vacancy to minus had been observed. But not far below that was the minus to the neutral. So one would think if I just slide both of these down that I should find a neutral to plus transition, and indeed we did that. You reverse the argument for the boron vacancy. Now for the boron vacancy in the neutral state, the boron occupies a position that's a second nearest neighbor to the vacancy. But the electron counting argument is the same, except the other way. The neutral vacancy is isoelectronic to the boron vacancy minus. Well, our vacancy states neutral plus to double plus. If you slide those upwards, you would expect to see a zero to minus transition, and indeed, that's what we found. And again, you can believe these because both of these new states are outside the range of error that DFT has exhibited for the other defects. The largest error we had was a quarter of a volt. Both of these new levels are more than a quarter of a volt from a band edge, therefore they're going to be real. Okay, so now to wrap up, what I've shown you is how you start with a code like sequest, which is a standard DFT supercell code. But you can't just push the button and expect the right answer to come out. In order to be able to do the defect level calculations, we needed to come up with a robust computational model of our defect. Our calculation didn't do exactly what it is that we wanted, an isolated defect. So we did some machinery, fixed the boundary conditions, found a good chemical potential, added the bulk polarization, and explicitly dealt with the banding of the defects, the interaction. The model isn't fully complete. There are still things that need to get worked out. For example, one of the things I didn't mention to you, finite size effect, if I've got a defect and it causes a strain, I'm going to have an elastic response from the crystal. That's not in the calculations that I showed you. I know they're going to be somewhat small, so I don't worry about them. And for the purposes of computing the defect levels, they're going to exist in each of the charge states, so to a certain extent, it's going to cancel out. But if you want a complete theory, you would have to add elastic effects. And there are a few other details in the model that also need to be worked. But the real surprising thing is that you do vanilla LDA or PBE, right? You get really surprisingly accurate results for defect levels, average error to within a tenth of an EV, and it didn't matter what defect it was. And intrinsic defects, vacancies, interstitials, secondary defects, combination defects, first row, second row, top, bottom of the band gap. What you have is that LDA and PBE for all of the band gap problem are predictive to within a tenth of an EV, roughly, of defect levels to the point where you can, with confidence, predict the existence of new charge states. Since the time that we did these calculations, the phosphorus vacancy, somebody else scooped us. They did the experiment and then corresponding calculations. But you can, with confidence, predict these and use them in your modeling because you can quantify the error that you have in your calculations. The key to this is that the energy expression very deliberately and carefully avoided any inclusion of eigenvalues in the construction of the energy expression. There is no valence band edge. There is no conduction band edge. There is no eigenvalue. Everything was computed as differences of fully valid and well-grounded ground state energies. And DFT is a ground state theory, right? So therefore, you can trust it for ground state properties. And then the issue of the band gap problem, well, for the purposes of computing localized defect states from total energy calculations and looking at charge transitions, you don't have the band gap problem. You still have the problem of where are the band edges with respect to the defect ionization potentials you compute. That we haven't solved here, right? The problem is that we don't know how to compute those at the same level of theory that we can do the defects, right? In the defects, we know how to handle the static polarization effects. We know that we can get the structural energies to within a tenth or two of an EV. To get the band edges, we have to figure out how to do the excited state energies, because a valence band, taking an electron out of a valence band and putting it in the conduction band is excitation, right? And we can't do that at the same level of theory. But this leads you to the meta problem of how do we go about fixing the so-called band gap problem? There's been a lot of energy invested for the last 10, 15 years, new functionals, exact exchange, hybrid functionals, trying to fix the band gap problem, which is fixing the excitation energy from the valence band to the conduction band. And yet, LDA and PB are already doing well. Can we fix the band gap problem playing around with functionals without screwing up the wonderful results we're getting with already the standard local density functional problems? I'm going to do one more slide since we have a number of students in the audience. One of the lessons learned from this is be very careful of black boxes. Even something like Sequest. I like to think that I've written a very good code. But you have to know what goes into the calculation that you're doing, right? Know the assumptions that went into how the code does its calculations and control your approximations. A good place I can refer you to in controlling your approximation is a topical review primer that we wrote that went into modeling and simulation, material science and engineering, volume 13, R1. There's a sort of tips at how you go about doing these calculations systematically so that you can control your approximation. But it is important to know exactly what your code is doing, especially when you're playing with things like boundary conditions, things with charged systems, right? It's unacceptable to say, well, the code produced that number for me. Somebody might have put that into the code assuming something different than what you thought was in there, right? There is a gap between our tools. Our DFT codes are wonderful, great objects, right? They're great capabilities, but they're rarely designed to do exactly the problem that you want. Understand fully what you have to do to bridge that gap between what the calculation is actually producing, the numbers that you're producing, and the science that you're trying to simulate. Experimentalists do the same thing, right? The raw data that comes out of an experiment doesn't mean much until they've processed it to a form that they can interpret in terms of concepts that we can relate to in numbers, right? And then, again, the lessons. The path forward to how you develop more accurate functionals is not particularly clear, but the real lesson is that LDA, existing LDA and GGAs do really spectacularly well, better than people even expect. I'd like to give thanks to a few people. These are a number of people who are participating in this effort, and certainly in discussions, people like Ann Mattson, Ardo Edwards, Harry Helmerson, and Renee Vangenhoven, as I was trying to work through these issues of how we deal with boundary conditions, how related to band gap problem. But a person I'd like to really call out for thanks is Kevin Leung. All this started about 10 years ago. Been writing Sequest for almost 20 years now. And I've always wanted to add charge, the ability to do charge defects into the calculation, but I never really quite understood how to do it. Jellium was never quite satisfying, but I was never able to put my finger on what the problem was. And he said he wanted to use the code, and he said, I want to do a charge system. And I said, well, I don't know how to do a charge system for bulk calculation. And he asked what sounded like a really simple but stupid question. I don't care about bulk. I want to do a cluster, right? The light bulb went off. The thing is, my background was in molecular quantum chemistry, and I understood the boundary conditions for how to do a molecule. I know where vacuum is. I'm used to doing all of those integrals. I knew how to do it. And all of a sudden, the idea of these tails and building all of this machinery came to light as a result of one just very idle conversation. There is no such thing as a stupid question. Those sorts of questions are what can give people very key insights to solve very hard problems. And it was his question that led to this path and a lot of really good stuff. If you want to learn more about the code, you can go to the website. It's dft.sandia.gov/quest. And please do ask questions. I'm really sort of uncomfortable with the fact of having disappeared and no one's asking questions, because there's a lot of really difficult concepts buried in here. And thank you very much for your attention. Thank you, Alejandro, for inviting me to come out.
There, I'm trying to understand how this all fits into a multi-scale framework. Is there a code that simulates the generation of defects first?
Yes.
Does the output of these calculations go into a device simulator?
Yes. So the way Sandia has a whole system of codes where, okay, let's go back to the very beginning. I did a very stripped down ladder here that was, there's a code, essentially a binary collision code, Cascade. You might be familiar with a Cascade Marlowe, which is used to generate defect distributions, candidate defect distributions within a material. The DFT, and then there's also molecular dynamics calculations, which are trying to determine more at the end of range, where you get it down into the thermal energies, where you need the greater accuracy of force fields. And then we're doing DFT calculations, trying to quantify a number of the processes that are identified and the defects that are identified. So defect formation energies, reaction energies, and the like. You take those parameters, and then what you do is you feed them into a device code. You can think of it as a solid-state version of ChemKin, where you have a distribution of defects. You start off with some initial distribution of defects, some currents, some biases, an atomic configuration. You parameterize that model and allow that chemistry to evolve using drift diffusion equations, right? And then you take a look at how a transistor will perform over long periods of time, given some initial conditions within this. And then you try and compare those to experiment, right? So you've done experiments where you've subjected some device to, with a certain configuration, certain biases, to a certain radiation event, and then monitored its response over time. So it is a passing. It isn't a concurrent multiscale. What it is an information passing multiscale, where you identify and parameterize the physics that then feeds the next model. From the device simulator to the circuit simulator, you're also doing something similar to that. So here, you're trying to create something you can call a compact model. So instead of worrying about the detailed physics of what's happening in the transistor, you're trying to abstract some analytic or numerical reduced representation, which can then be fed into a circuit model. And you can put together thousands or even millions of these devices and then go screening through however many of these devices to try and work out the statistics of how these devices are going to respond. Yes. The capture cross-sections is something that we don't compute, right? The machinery to do that doesn't exist yet. So what the people who do this sort of thing, Sam Myers, Harry Helmerson, have long experience at what seem to be reasonable capture cross-sections for the carriers. There's some experimental data to help guide people, but really the way that's done, if you think about it, is empirical fitting. People have used certain capture cross-sections for certain simulations. They get results that don't quite line up with experiment, and over time, they refine on those parameters, which then give a better representation of experiment. Ideally, we would like to be able to compute them for first principles, but you certainly can't do it accurately enough to matter here. Well, I mean, that's what these are. These are deep traps, right? So it's the deep levels. The shallow levels are less of a concern for the purposes of recombination center, because these things...
There's something in between.
We do all of these calculations. So the stuff that I showed you, right, the machinery for the size of supercells we can do are only valid for things that you can call deep levels, because the states are only exponentially localized with respect to their distance from a band edge, right? So if you have a shallow donor like phosphorus, or shallow acceptor like boron, the state extends out for 30 angstrom. We can't hope to represent that with our small little models. So here we have sort of a fortuitous convergence where the defects we're really interested in are not sort of the shallow levels. We're interested in things essentially more than a tenth of an EV away from a band edge. And the reason are because you get sort of a really good capture cross-section for both electrons running along in the conduction band to come here, but then after that for a hole to come up and annihilate it. So it's essentially a good catalyst center for destroying the carriers that you care about. Yeah.
Trap electrons,
there is a whole different kettle of fish associated with that. That particularly becomes important at interfaces. And there's another set of radiation damage taking a look at the silicon-silica interface, particularly near junction, where you have problems with trapped charge, and the fields generated by trapped charge then affect in a large way the transport of carriers through the junction of the device. That's a completely different problem. It's also one that we're interested in, but it's not one that I talked about here. And it's more complicated there because from a computational perspective, when you have an interface, the number of atoms you need to include in your problem in order to work out a reasonable energy expression becomes much, much larger, right? For the beginning, we focused on just the bulk silicon because people believe that they have models that are good enough to represent what's happening at the interface. There's some debate on whether those models are good enough. But in the bulk, not being able to do the basic chemistry of the primary defects, the interstitial and the vacancy, was crippling everything. I mean, that's what you see the most of, and what we're most interested in was a very short time evolution. And we had no information at all about the interstitial, for example. So that was absolutely crucial to get that.
All right, so let's thank Peter again.